Yeah.
All right.
Man,
get the whole family around and sit down and watch this one.
I don't think a black family would do very well with this movie, just because we'd all be yelling at the screen for the last 3 minutes. Everyone to another episode of It's Just Jokes. My name is Joshua Chapman, aka Slim Balor, aka Baby Giannis, aka Mr. Take Your Girl in Front Your Face. I'm here with my co-host as always. First, Jesse Pink.
Yo.
Aka Dolomite P, aka Baby Samoa Joe, aka Groovy Grizzly. Why? Because he keeps it raw on you hoes. Next is Kobe Price.
What up?
Aka the homie Kobe, aka Mr. The Price is Right, aka Kobe. And last but certainly not least, Derek Small.
What's going on, people?
A.K.A. D. Smalls, A.K.A. Anthony Mackie Jr., A.K.A. Damn, Derek, where'd you find this pod? Shout out to Dre for everything behind the scenes and for the intro music. We appreciate you. And we have our first official guest. Dre doesn't count. Dre's one of us. He's in our production meetings and all that kind of stuff.
He's the regular.
He doesn't count as a guest. Our first official guest, future Emmy winner, future Oscar winner, a thespian, Travis Lincoln Cox, aka T-Raz, aka the Lincoln Actor, aka TLC. What is up, Travis?
Oh man, I love that. I have to be honest, I was really hoping for some nicknames, man. And I got you. That's nice. Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. I was joking before we got on that when I heard your voice, I'm so used to seeing you in that Joanne the Shaw rather, what you acted in, and I was like, man, where's the Southern accent? Where's that? Like, this guy is not the same person. I was like, oh yeah, he is an actor.
Yeah, imagine. Yeah, it's crazy, right? Yeah, for that, I watched a lot of YouTube videos for that one.
Which YouTube videos did you watch for that one?
Yeah.
I watched a lot of Appalachia.
Yeah.
A lot of, like, there's a great, super interesting documentary about, like, Appalachia living I found on YouTube, and I just watched, like, the whole hour and a half of that. That accent is thick, man. It's crazy. Yeah.
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 That's a whole different world, dude. Like, Appalachia, like, it's crazy.
It is. I was super fascinating to learn, like, the history about it, and like I think it was the Irish and Scottish people came in and they weren't welcome in New York, so they went down and they made their own place, and it's still like their own place, and it's really just this like bubble. And I don't want to talk bad about the people of Appalachia, because you probably have a lot of listeners from there.
Oh, we have so many. There's so many listeners in Appalachia listening to black men. So many.
Global, baby.
Yeah. Let's just say that there are consequences to living in a bubble as far as like how you deal with the outside world. We'll just say that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So learning that kind of accent, like, I guess, how do you maintain it throughout the entire filming process? Do you like, if we take a break, do you like stop? You're like, all right, I can relax. I can be normal.
It's tricky. I'm not what you call a method actor, so I don't stay in character from start to finish, but there is a muscle memory that comes from talking that way for sure. So as I'm like learning it and I'm on set, even after I would come home from the shoot day, it's the muscle memory of talking that way is definitely, it kind of lingers and then trails off. Usually by the end of the night, I'm back to normal and then pick it up again the next day. But it definitely, in between takes and stuff, I guess you'd have to ask who was there, but I think it probably did stay with that accent while I was on set.
And we could keep talking about Southern accents and everything that goes into it. We kind of wanted to touch on your most recent film, or one that came out about a week ago, maybe 2 weeks at this point.
As of this recording, it's going to be past spooky season by the time you guys hear it. So apologies, but
this will actually make a perfect Halloween watch or post Halloween watch too, with the
way
that
great
goes.
For that pre-Thanksgiving vibe. Definitely is. Yeah.
Man, yeah.
All right.
man.
Get the whole family around and sit down and watch this one.
I don't think a black family would do very well with this movie, just because we'd all be yelling at the screen for the last 3 minutes.
Yeah,
that's funny.
But go ahead, Kobe.
And also don't have anyone under the age of maybe 10. It's a good number. Maybe 10, probably. Yeah, yeah. But we're talking about Phone Home, the short horror film that you did. We just got to jump right into it. How did you feel playing that character? And there's one thing I want to ask about, but I want to know how you felt playing the character that you did in that time.
Yeah, man. I mean, for anyone who hasn't seen it, basically everyone's seen it at this point, clearly.
Yeah, go watch it if you haven't seen it.
Watch it.
Yeah. Respect you can find it on YouTube, Phone Home, the movie. I don't know. Yeah, it's a very emotional role. I think I spend basically the whole movie in tears, and it just takes a toll physiologically. I think all actors enjoy that. Like, I would say that it was fun to do, but I was exhausted for sure at the end of the day, and my eyes are raw, and like, it's just definitely, so how it felt to play that character is tiring. Yeah, but the set was fun because of that. The director, Aria Jackson, awesome young new director, she was great, and we had a great rapport right away. So the atmosphere on set, believe it or not, was very light and funny. We'd crack jokes with each other in between takes, which I think helped keep that like stamina going, so it's not so heavy all the time, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like if you guys were like not fun on set, this would have been a very different like experience for you, you know what I mean? Like,
oh yeah, 100%.
Because you were major sad vibes throughout this entire movie.
Yeah,
major sad vibes. Yeah.
You, man, I was sad for you. I was want to hug this man.
I knew the way it opened up. I was just like, oh, I'm in for one with this. I was like, I'm in. Yeah. I didn't. I was like, it just.
You start like, off the movie crying. I was like, well, damn.
He's staring like right into the picture. Like he's literally staring right into the picture, and I was like, oh yeah, this reminds me of like some like good TV, like right here. Like this is like we're gonna go on an emotional roller coaster with this one. Like I just
knew. It's funny you say that, because the actress, we actually shot that opening scene was on the last day. It wasn't the last thing we shot, but it was on the last day. And the girl who like comes up and asks if I'm okay, she was like, I just want to give you a hug. So after every take, we hugged because she was just like so sad about it. So.
How do you just mentally get into that role then? Like, what do you do preparing? Like, are you telling yourself, all right, you just can't cry. You just can't cry. You just can't cry.
Yeah, actually, believe it or not. I mean, if you take acting classes, how do you know that? That's a lot of people feel like when you're doing an emotional scene, you're trying to like force the tears out and like you really want to cry. But if you think about what happens in real life when you're about to cry, you like it's natural to try to hold it in, right? Like nobody, I mean, very few people, unless they're super emotionally healthy, are just like, let it out, you know? It's natural to hold it back. So it's actually, for me, crying, I just start physiologically with like, oh, when I cry, I breathe a lot and like my face sort of tightens up and like I get kind of this weird feeling in my nose, and you go through like the physiological actions and that triggers your body to be like, I guess we're sad now. And then the emotion sort of comes along for the ride.
Okay. I was going to say, please do not start crying on this show. Like, please, because I heard the voice starting to cry. I was like, hey.
That's pretty interesting take, because I've heard like from different acting classes, though, that in order to get into that particular role, especially like, let's say you're reciting a monologue, if you will, and you know, you don't have any props per se. You have to just, let's say, use your imagination and maybe like use on previous memories in order to conjure those type of emotions. But that is a very interesting take, and that does make sense. Typically, we do just hold back our emotions unless, like you say, you're very emotionally healthy and you're like, no, let that out. Just like imagine being on set and you're like, okay, cry. And it's like, okay.
Yeah, I don't have that skill. I wish I did. It does take me a minute to sort of like ramp up into it. But that's what's great about acting, though, is everyone's got their own method. Like some people will do that like memory recall where they'll go to a personal experience where they were actually really sad, and they'll bring that emotion into the scene. For me personally, I'm playing a character, so my own experiences, I'm not trying to like connect those dots. I don't know if that makes sense. So I guess I like to keep those separately and just and live in the world of the character, and then just do a little tricks here and there to bring the emotion along. And I'll be honest with you guys, I shouldn't say this because they might take my Emmy away, but by the end of the day, when you're crying for like 3 days straight, eventually your body's just like, no, man, I'm not doing that anymore. So there are some takes where I take some Vicks Vapor Rub and I put that under my eyes and I get it going, you know.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it doesn't feel good, but it tells the story, which is ultimately what actors are trying to do. We're just trying to tell a story. So
that is dedication right there.
That's dedication and that's passion. So like, so where does that actual like passion for acting come from? Is it something that you knew you always wanted to do, or maybe sort of like struggled along the way figuring out, or what?
Yeah, that's interesting, man, because I don't know where it came from. Like, neither of my parents are actors. I mean, my mom's a nurse, my dad is a business owner. So I don't know why I was drawn to it. And it took me a long time to figure out that it's actually what I wanted. If I look back on my childhood, I can sort of see like, oh yeah, of course this is where I wanted to go. Like when I was a kid, I would set up my family's video camera and play. Do you guys ever watch Whose Line Is It Anyway? That
yes, improv I love show. That show. I was actually just watching that.
I was obsessed with that show as a kid. And so I'd set up my parents' video camera and I would just like play those games by myself, or if I could get my friends to play with me, I would. But I didn't even know, I wasn't even aware that like being an actor was a thing. So I never thought about it in a professional sense. And it wasn't until my senior year of high school where I finally worked up the courage to audition for a play. I did my first play to West Side Story in high school.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
And it was, I fell in love, man. It was like, oh, this
were
is
you,
so
were
fun.
Were you a Jet or a Shark?
Jet, baby. When you're a Jet, okay. You're a Jet all the way. Obviously. Yeah, man. I played action. And man, I really fell in love. And I realized through the course of my life, the reason why I do it now is it's fun. You know, I heard this study where people are motivated by different things. Some people are motivated by power. Some people are motivated by money. Some people are motivated by status. And I'm motivated by fun. I really am. I wish I could say like, I just want to heal the world through my art, but honestly, it's just a ton of fun. So.
Yeah, that's fair.
No, that's real, because when you mentioned the two things, when you mentioned the vapor thing, when I was thinking, man, I don't think I would ever want to do that for any role that I had to do. Two, it also made me think back to high school. We had a friend, Josh, Josh knows him, his name's Sam. He went around giving us, like, he had us do it. He was like, yeah, just put this under your eye or something. I did it, and I instantly started crying. So I was like, oh, yeah, I could see why that would work so well for you, because that burns like hell.
For sure. And to be clear, that only is, like, one piece of the puzzle, right? Like, that gets the actual tears to come. But you still got to be responsible for bringing, like, the emotion to the scene, right? Tears by themselves, people will see right through that, so.
Right.
I guess up to this point, what have been some of your favorite roles that you've done so far? We're going to touch on another film later, but other roles you've had since high school.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, the cliche is that every role is fun for different reasons.
Boo.
Which is true.
We don't want to hear
Give us the real answer.
We want the tea.
All right, if I had to pick just a couple roles that were the most fun, I got to play Macbeth. And I had to play Macbeth, which obviously that's like an iconic role. And that was a dream. There's a little short indie feature film called Back to Awesome that is a cute little film. I think you can find it on Amazon for anyone who wants to go watch it. But I got to play this like ski bum of a dude who doesn't have any direction in his life. And it sort of got to do all of the things that actors love to do. Like, I'm sort of the comic relief through the movie, but I also have this scene where I break down and cry, and there's like this like argument scene. So I got to be angry and yell. I really got to play like the whole spectrum of emotion. Plus I got to spend a month up in Lake Tahoe making movies. So that whole experience was really a dream. So that's at the top of the list for me.
Okay. You mentioned different characters play. I have a would you rather. So would you rather be a character that only gives exposition throughout the entire movie, so you're only there to explain stuff, Or would you rather be a one note character? Like you're only angry the entire time, or you're only funny, or you're only sad.
Oh, that's rough, man. That's rough because giving exposition is one of the, I guess it depends on how well it's written, but that's one of the worst things an actor has to do is like force the information in a way that's just not organic. Cause nobody, like, I'm not going to see you on the street and be like, oh, hey, Josh, this friend of mine that I met in Ireland a year ago, welcome to my apartment that I've lived in for 10 years. Like, nobody talks like that. So when it's written in, exposition is written in, it's really tough.
Or like the sci-fi based movies where it's just like the scientist is only there to explain like the positives and negatives and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Just like let me lay it all out, and then the rest of you can play on this scene that I built. Oh, I guess I'd probably take the one note person because at least as an actor, I know what like where I'm going. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's like if I'm the funny guy or if I'm the angry guy, then I can just lean into that and have fun with it. It is unfortunate when you don't get to like paint with more than one color, but I would choose that. That's a great question though. That was not easy.
Yeah, for sure. I think I'd have to agree with you because like angry, you could just be like over the top angry at that point and everyone's just like, oh, whatever. You're the exposition right. guy. It's just like, come on, man. Like not you again.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's the worst. That's why writers are so important because they sneak that information in if you're a good writer and you don't even notice they did it.
That's dope. Well, I want to ask you about on your other films too. You know, you talked about Phone Home. Like we all agree, like Phone Home was like really dope to watch and really dope to see. Kobe referenced like one of your other films that we saw, and I wanted to particularly talk about your. What was your method into getting into that particular film? I know we kind of danced around it, but in terms of like, you know, the type of voice acting that you did, you know, the type of accents that you did too. Can you talk more about how you got into that particular role?
For those that don't know what we're talking about, Joe and the Straw. Go watch that too, you coward. Yes,
go watch that immediately. Give my man his Emmy.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah. That was a really... a great project to work on. The director, Nicole Balavan, she's also the writer, was great. It's rare in film, especially short film, to have rehearsals. And I think we had like 3 or 4 rehearsals before we actually shot that film. And it's because she wanted the pacing right. And she wanted, we sort of like collaborated on the specific dialogue that would happen. And we really talked about, you know, where Joe is coming from and like, how Kelly reacts to all of that. And it was an interesting role to play for me because I mean, I grew up, I don't know if Josh knows this about me, but I'm a little bit redneck. Like I grew up in Utah, like camping, fishing, hiking. I shot my first handgun when I was 4 years old, you know, like that was all part of my life. Like I've got some redneck in me. So I know people like Joe, you know, I'm related to people like Joe, you know, like, so it was interesting to approach him with a sense of empathy. And that's one of my favorite things about the film is in the first half of the film, like Joe seems like a nice guy. And Joe definitely thinks he's a nice guy. Joe would tell anyone, I'm a great dude. Like I'm polite, I'm nice to people. He probably holds the door open for people he sees on the street, you know, but like far too many people who grow up that way, he has just such a limited view of the world. And he really is scared of things that he doesn't understand. So about halfway through the film, he's confronted with this thing that he doesn't understand and reacts so poorly. You know, he's very uncomfortable and scared and gets angry and defensive like so many people do. And I think it's a really human story, and it really shines a light on one of the major flaws of society right now.
I love how you have that type of view on it. I think it really speaks to just the type of precision, if you will, or the type of accuracy you have in your method or in your acting. I wouldn't call you necessarily a method actor because you say you wouldn't call yourself that. But I'm just more so talking about how methodical you are in this, right? How you're saying, you know, because I know Joel. Or like we all probably know one. But it's nice to see how you're saying you're taking this personal reaction or this personal interaction, you're reflecting it on society. It's like one of those sociological things. Like, it's like you and society and how you contribute to that.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate that, man. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Derek.
Oh, no, I was just going to ask because I heard him bring it up. So I kind of wanted to ask him how it felt. You said you approached that role from an empathy standpoint. So, like, how did it feel having to, like, I guess, portray somebody like that? But, like, think about it. Like, I'm trying to show the world, like, this is kind of how that person thinks. But also knowing how much of a negative connotation that has, or how much of a negative connotation people who think like that have, you know, in terms of, like, general society. Like, how did that feel, like, as an actor having to do that?
Yeah, it was sort of a dilemma because, how do I say this? Some actor somewhere that I don't remember brought up a really good point that you can't judge your characters. If you're going to play a character, you can't judge them. You have to find a way to understand them. You don't have to agree with them. You don't have to like them, but you do have to understand them. So approaching Joe that way, again, I think it goes back to realizing that people like Joe who are live in this bubble and are afraid are, there's just that there's so much fear, you know, is motivated by fear. So it's just sort of trying to tap into like, why would a person act this way? I think it's part of the reason why so many actors become philanthropists and are so like good, like giving generous people is because they spend their time understanding the motivations of bad guys. And they realize that, you know, everybody's flawed. Everyone has issues. Everyone has things they're working with. So getting a chance to sort of step into this very flawed person and try to pick apart why they feel that way instead of just judging them for feeling that way. I mean, it's probably something that we all should be doing. So yeah, those scenes at the end where, you know, he's spouting off all of that hate is not fun. You know, it's not a good feeling, but it's also like, it does come from a place of like, I mean, I can at least see how he got here. You know, this is a total side tangent. I don't know if you guys are listening to Rabbit Hole. It's a podcast called Rabbit Hole. And it's all about like how the YouTube algorithm is like spinning people down these like paths. Like someone could be innocently watching some like news program. And then the suggested video will be like, here's this thing that's just a little bit further one direction. And then here's this suggested video that's another little bit down that direction. And then, you know, 6 months later, YouTube's recommending these like super extremist, like crazy viewpoints. And it's like sort of like brainwashing people. So you can sort of see how like someone like Joe, who's probably on there watching all of this like propaganda stuff. I mean, he talks about like he wanting Texas to secede from the Union and all of these crazy ideas. But you almost feel bad for people like that because they're just victims of the, not all victims, because they're making choices for sure. There's accountability there. Yeah. But they are, it's the society that they're around. It's the bubble that they're, the information they're taking in is enforcing and strengthening and deepening these beliefs.
Yeah.
I think it's very, oh, go ahead, Justin.
No, I was going to say, yeah, I know by the time that this podcast drops, it's going to be even more timely. I mean, we're in an even more timely year that we're talking about how, you know, certain particular views, be it extreme, moderate, or liberal, are really shaping everyone's viewpoints as the way or in the direction of which this country should go. And in some regards, it's really talking about very socio-political issues that we have been battling with since the beginning of this country, and it's just a lot of things. So it's really interesting that you're thinking about all these things with this character. Again, it speaks to the methodological process. I cannot speak today, but the part that you're talking about, what I was mentioning to you earlier, you know, how you took this one personal character and you're reflecting it on society and society itself. But I'm wondering, because you mentioned, you know, about Utah, and I mean, sociopolitically speaking, Utah is a conservative state, very Mormon predominantly. I was wondering, like, do you see Joel? Like, and have you seen, can you see a Joel, like, you know, in Utah, like, in your own backyard, you know, where you live?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. I think Joe is in any bubble community like Appalachia, like we said, like people who are very comfortable where they're at and they don't expand their worldview past their neighborhood, you're going to see people like Joe. And it's unfortunate. And I don't really know what the answer is, because it's just these echo chambers. And to be fair, there's echo chambers on both sides of the political spectrum. Like, I think everyone needs to like look outside their neighborhood and try to understand where people are coming from. But yeah, definitely. I mean, there are a lot of Joes in Utah. And also, just to be fair to all my Utah people listening, I love Utah. There's amazing people in Utah too, but it certainly is a culture bubble. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, it's very interesting to hear you talk about that sort of thing, because I think not only does where you grow up shape your worldview, but also, like, you know, obviously your race too, because, you know, you talk about these sort of things in a way that maybe I didn't consider, because that type of thinking is less, oh, this is how this person is and they need to expand their worldview, and like, and more like, this is a threat to me and my humanity at some point. So it's definitely very interesting to hear you talk about that. And even some of the reactions that, you know, I even feel, because, you know, or Jesse or Derek or whoever may feel, you know, like, that is very interesting.
Yeah, that's such a good point you bring up too, of just like, all of our life experiences are different. They just are. And there's a lot of things that make our experiences different, but race is a huge one for sure. Like, the way I grew up and the things I experienced in Southern Utah as a white guy are just, it would be impossible for us to see the world in the same way. Even though we're trying, and like, things like your podcast are amazing, because you guys are out there and you're talking and you're like, you're sharing your world. You're making it easier for people like me to get a glimpse into your world. Because otherwise there's, you know, people in Appalachia or Appalachia, they're going to just shred me.
They'll be fine. You know, if they find this podcast, they'll be fine. Like, whatever.
They'll be all right. Yeah. Pockets of like Southern Utah, or even like little small towns in Texas or wherever they are, things like this podcast, and like, there's making it sort of like breaking down those walls so we can see farther and farther and get, you know, share the world with each other and try to understand each other. Cause once we understand each other, then we don't have to be afraid of each other. And I think that's the biggest, all of the major issues are stem from fear, in my opinion.
Exactly. Exactly. So even keeping it centered, even on Utah, the film definitely highlighted different dynamics when it comes to race and cultural relationships in our country, right? So,
yeah.
So you said you grew up in Utah, so kind of even transitioning it a little bit. Talk about kind of your fandom history when it comes to the Utah Jazz, and kind of how you felt about the different things that were going on with the NBA bubble. From a team standpoint, from Donovan Mitchell's individual campaigns, you know, how did that affect you as a fan, everything that was going on? Just dive into that a little bit.
Yeah, just, you're talking specifically about the Black Lives Matter movement and Donovan Mitchell kind of being a voice for that and that kind of thing?
Yeah. And everything that was kind of going on in the bubble.
Yeah, I've been a diehard Jazz fan my whole life. And Donovan Mitchell from day one stole all of our hearts for sure, which is why I am so proud and happy that he's been so vocal and he's been such a figure and such a leader, because it's been extremely discouraging to see the way, I don't know if you guys have checked in on it, but the way a lot of fans have reacted to his platform is so depressing, man. I mean, they're, you know, it's that, stick to sports, you know, keep politics out of sports. We love you, Donovan, but like,
I don't mean to cut you off, but we definitely notice every single time there's an athlete that speaks up, that says something, LeBron, Kaepernick, whoever, it does not matter. The first thing is like, you just stick to sports. And it's like, dude, like, okay, you're a plumber, or you're whatever, like, you're a banker. Like, what gives you more right to talk about the things that are politics and the things that are affecting you than this dude that can also like dribble a basketball? Like,
right. Yeah, no, that's, you're so right about that. But I mean, especially, I mean, the Utah Jazz fan base has a bad reputation for that anyway, with the whole Russell Westbrook thing and just, you know, to the organization's credit, that fan was banned for life. No questions asked. And they've been nothing but supportive to Donovan and the other players. But the Utah community needs a guy like Donovan to just keep being vocal. You know, on Twitter, a lot of the Jazz fans are like, Donovan's going to leave. I don't blame him. This fan base doesn't deserve him, which is probably true. But, man, do we need him? You know, like a guy like Donovan for his first two seasons just like blew us out of the water. He's the first Jazz player to get a signature shoe since Karl Malone. And Karl Malone's shoe is terrible. He's just, I mean, he's in the trash spotlight. We never get that in Utah. We never get that guy. And the fact that he is who he is, he's such a likable dude too. He's so charming and so charismatic. And he's like, his rookie year, he like went around Salt Lake City and just showed up at people's 4th of July barbecues. Like, he's a man of the people and we love him. So, man, he's the perfect guy. If anyone is going to like break through that bubble, if anyone's going to like get into that sheltered culture of the way things are, it's Donovan, man. And I hope he keeps doing it. I hope he just gets louder. And I think he has more support than people realize. There's a lot of people who are very supportive of him, but there's certainly far too many people fighting back, and it needs to change. And hopefully it does one person at a time.
Oh, go ahead, Derek.
No, I was just going to say, to even kind of bring up a point that Josh made in one of our previous episodes, sports and politics have always, in a way, been intertwined, right? Like, the people who make...
Yeah, listen to that. I love that. I love that point, Josh, though. It's like, shut up and dribble has never been a thing, man. Like, never. I love that.
Yeah, like, the people who make these comments act like they have never been intertwined. And, you know, and as Black athletes, I don't understand how, you know, fans or just the audience in general can act like these players can just have to go about their lives as if they're only athletes, right? Like, they can be they can be multidimensional. So,
yeah, absolutely. First of all, let's just talk about the idea of like keeping politics and sports separate. I mean, that's just an insane idea when you consider the fact we start every game with the national anthem. Like, that's political. Every single sports organization in the country does a support our troops theme. They bring the veteran out onto the field and the audience cheers up and claps. Like, politics and sports have always been connected. So this idea that like, I'm support your view. I'm all about it, but I just want my sports to be entertainment. Like, that's such a bullshit argument, considering the other thing. If you really had a problem with politics, you wouldn't want the anthem. You wouldn't want these support our troops things. You just have a problem with these politics that challenge you, that scare you, that you don't understand.
Yeah, Roy Woods Jr. made a really good point when you talked about they bring out military members and all that kind of stuff. He was like, you know, they give them great seats, they do the wave and all that kind of stuff, they honor them, but they never give them the mic to allow them to speak on issues, because once veterans would start to speak on, even like veteran, like, we don't even treat veterans great when they come back, right? Like,
terrible.
There's a lot of like homeless vets out there that shouldn't be. There's a lot of people that are suffering from PTSD and all that kind of stuff that never get their support. And we don't even, when we're even honoring them, is literally like, you know, like I said, like just the wave and the, oh, here's some nice seats, thanks for your service, good luck with all your mental issues, like
yeah exactly, thanks for, you know, risking your life and damaging your whole worldview, and you're going to have issues that you'll never be able to fully comprehend, but enjoy the game. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I'll say this quick thing. So technically I'm a geographer in training. I'm going to grad school now to be a geographer. And one of the things that we look at is not necessarily how space physically divides people, but we see how culture divides people too. And we see how both physical geography and cultural geography actually works in demarcating folks. Right. I want to just comment and say, in a weird sense, I see kind of similarities between you and Donovan. On one side of the fence, like in your film, you know, and we just talked about this, you know, about your methodology, you know, and breaking that down for the actor. and how you were able to, in a sense, culturally take, let's say, a culture in one regional area, right? And hopefully, like, through the proliferation of your work, you're able to spread that in physically in different areas and in different cultures. It's almost as if, like, you see that kind of reflection in Donovan Mitchell and you advocating for him to stay there, right? Donovan Mitchell clearly comes from a different culture than the predominantly white community and Mormon community there in Utah. And he's essentially, and for him just being there is already politicized, right? And then just to go to all your points about sports being political, you can't really do that when a majority of a sports league is black. So you have to talk about that. And, you know, it's really interesting that he's already political and just him being there, but him just talking about it, you know, just talking about these issues, just him physically, not only physically being there, but culturally being there too. I'm like, I'm kind of seeing a similarity between you in terms of your respective lane of acting and how he is too, and that both don't shy away from conversations about race and racial disparities. But you also understand that geographically speaking, culturally speaking, people are scattered across different places. So you use your platform to talk about it in different areas. So that was just like my long-winded shout out to you, because I really did just notice that.
Jesse is a PhD candidate, so he does that from time to time.
Listen, I understand that. I once I get going, it's hard to stop me. But I really appreciate that. I mean, I'll take that compliment any day for sure. I think there's something to that of, you know, just being who you are and being, I mean, there's nobody more authentic and genuine than Donovan. And I try to be authentic and genuine. And if we all can do that, then hopefully, again, I know I keep repeating the same stuff, but it's all about just try to like understand each other instead of fighting with each other. It will be a huge step. But part of that comes from like, oh, he's a genuine good dude. I think someone like Donovan Mitchell, who is standing up and saying these things, like nobody, even if you disagree with him, nobody's looking at Donovan Mitchell being like, that's a bad dude. Like, that's a bad dude. Like, nobody thinks that. Like, there are people where it's challenging, that's forcing them to come up with other reasons why someone would feel that way. Like, oh, he just doesn't get it, or he, you know, whatever. They'll always find reasons. But because he's so genuine and authentic, they can't say he's bad, you know?
Well, speaking of like getting along and those tough working relationships, we saw that strained a little bit in March when the coronavirus was going off and his teammate Rudy Gobert was patient zero essentially in the NBA. You know, we don't know who had it before that, but he was the first announced case, and that's when the NBA shut down. And there were reports of him and Donovan having an icy relationship a bit after that, because Donovan got sick, and you know, whether or not they were friends or were amicable after that. And I think basically they have a working relationship. They're not the best of friends, but they are able to like work through these sort of things. Can you talk about, as a fan, like how that, when you first saw that, like how that impacted you, and even like, where do you think they're, you know, how you look at their relationship now, like, you know, post bubble, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah. I hated every second of it. I was devastated, especially because we're coming from like maybe the most like likable, certainly most likable Jazz team, probably one of the most likable NBA teams ever, when you've got like Ricky Rubio and Jay Crowder and Joe Ingles, and like all the behind the scenes stuff with that team is they're just best friends. They're joking around, they're goofing off, they're shooting commercials together. And we're like, they love each other. They're best friends. And then, you know, poor Rudy is patient zero and the whole world turns on him. And let me just defend Rudy Gobert real quick, because, you know, he makes the jokes with the mics. He's touching the mics and he's doing the bit, which obviously in hindsight was a terrible decision. But we didn't know yet. Like, there was some information out, but we didn't. Literally the day before that happened, I had an improv show. I put my fingers in my teammate's mouth. Like, it was a terrible thing to do. Looking back, it was a huge mistake. But so I feel for Rudy Gobert because he
did. Travis, I'm sorry. Travis, I'll
Rudy Gobert. All right.
Travis, you guys aren't going to let me, roll past that?
I love you. That might be a white thing, buddy. Like,
yeah. Yeah. That's just, yeah. Yeah.
You guys don't sympathize with Rudy?
No. I like that. I'm talking about the hand in the mouth.
Yeah. Like, no, dude, listen, the improv in improv, there's no rules. All right. We've been playing together for 7 years. We've kissed each other.
I get for improv is yes and. So you just really can't say no to nothing. I understand that. But that's where you go like, I'm going to put my fingers in my mouth. Yes. And when you do that, I'm kicking your ass.
Yeah. Or it could be one of those yes, or we could do this.
Or how about
something else? Yeah.
I don't even remember the context of the scene. It probably wasn't a very funny choice. But my point is that it happened, you know. We weren't thinking about like germs and stuff. So anyway, to get back to your original question, I feel for Rudy Gobert, and as a fan, watching the world turn on Rudy and like all the memes and all the jokes and all the stuff was just like, no, that's our guy. We love that guy. And then it got worse when it was like, wait a minute, are he and Donovan fighting? And then the rumors started and the articles were happening. And when it got really bad as a fan was when Donovan didn't correct anybody, you know, like everyone, we live in a world where if there's a rumor that's not true, it takes you 30 seconds to get on Twitter to say, hey, this rumor's not true. And he didn't do that. So we were all like, oh no, like this is true. And I Donovan since come out and said like, we're cool, we're fine. But I definitely think there was some ice. And even still, I don't think they're friends. I think Rudy's a very passionate, competitive dude. I'd run through a brick wall for Rudy Gobert. I mean, I don't know if you guys know the situation. My wife's going through cancer right now, and he sent her a signed jersey that was like, stay strong, Whitney. And like, he retweets her photos about like going through the process. So I love Rudy Gobert, diehard fan, but I can sort of see how it might be a tough guy to be a teammate with because of how he's just like wants to win more than anything. And he's probably not very tactful with the way he interacts with his teammates. So as a fan now, it's a little rough. There's a lot of like speculation about, are the Jazz going to be forced to move on from him? Are they going to try to force a trade? Because chemistry is obviously important. So it's not comfortable. I hate it. I hope they find a way to stick together and work it out because they're two of my favorite basketball players ever. But we'll see what happens, I guess.
Nah, and that's very a grand gesture that Rudy Gobert did for your wife. But let's make this very clear. If that man wasn't 7 foot and a 3-time defensive player of the year, they would have shipped that man. He would have been gone. He would have been up out of here. All right.
Yeah. But he's so good, man. That's
yeah,
the
he's
thing.
So good.
He's so good.
He's
good. And I think as an anchor.
And this is why I think they're going to work it out, because Donovan wants to win more than anything. Rudy wants to win more than anything. They'll work it out. Like Shaq and Kobe hated each other, you know, like they didn't get along at all. And they won however many, three championships? Three championships together. No
COVID, Travis. That's the monkey in it. Like there was reports of people dying from that, man. I don't know. Like you just can't go look past that.
Yeah, I think to your point, Travis, though, I think they will work it out. And I think one of the main reasons I think that is because, like you said, or Jesse said, it's so hard. It would be so hard for the Jazz to get equal value for the stuff that Rudy does on the defensive end.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I also think the Jazz value Rudy more than anybody else in the league. I mean, Rudy gets so much slander because he can't shoot a jump shot or because he can't guard Steph Curry on the perimeter. It's like, first of all, nobody can guard Steph Curry on the perimeter. Second of all, that's not what his main thing is. So I think there are a lot of people in the league that undervalue Rudy, and the Jazz have a lot of value. So I just don't think they're going to find anyone who would meet them where they would need to be met if they were going to trade him, you know?
Yeah. And on top of the, you know, like we said, like, I don't think people ideally, and you talked about Twitter and all that kind of stuff, and Twitter can sometimes be a vacuum and like, oh, everyone thinks this, and that's not necessarily the case, but people want your two best players to be best friends and buddy buddy. Like Mike and Scotty didn't even like each other all the time, right? Like Mike would be sitting there like, come on, Scotty, like why are you not showing, or he would ride him and all that kind of stuff. And they were arguably the greatest duo the NBA has ever seen, right? Like, it's so rare to have two guys that not only complement each other's games, but complement each other off the court and all that kind of stuff, and are so amicable. And that just doesn't happen.
They might be second to Stockton and Malone, but yeah, they were sorry.
Okay. How many? Didn't they go 6-for-6?
Yeah.
Including two over the Jazz?
Yeah.
All right. Greg Ostertag was on that team. All right.
We all saw The Last Dance, Travis. We all know how this.
talk about being a rough year for Jazz fans, man. We got the Rudy stuff. We got the Donovan drama. Bogey got hurt. And then we had to watch The Last Dance to relive the most painful thing in our history. It was tough. It was a tough year to be a Jazz fan.
I will say, after that one shot, it's like the Jazz just went.
We had a couple glimpses of being good. Like, you know, Darren Williams was great.
Shout out to Darren Williams, Illinois boy.
Yeah, dude. Oh man, he's fantastic. So we had some flashes of being good again, but it's been a rough stretch for sure. So that's why it's so exciting. That's why this Donovan Rudy drama is so scary, is because we're finally we're at least. It's not insane to say we have a chance. Like, nobody's saying we're favorites, but
you guys are in that second tier in the West.
Yeah, we're at least back. Yeah, we're at least back in that conversation, and so to have it be fragile again is like, no, we can't do this again. I mean, Hayward left us, and that was devastating. We just, oh man, the stakes are high. The stakes are high for Rudy and Donovan to work it out.
I actually think y'all are more dynamic after the Hayward trade. I mean, of course, that's also because of Donovan. Then you also get Joe Ingles and all. No, it's. Y'all are more dynamic and more defensively focused. Y'all are probably one of the most balanced teams in the NBA. And it took one Frenchman with COVID-19 to mess that up. That's wild. That's nuts.
Yeah. Jesse, relax. No, that's real. That's real.
Oh, man.
2020 is full of a lot of surprises. Wow.
Yeah, for sure.
We talk. Jesse just mentioned 2020 throwing surprises, and you talked about it with Donovan and how just how outspoken he was in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement and really getting his voice out there. I mean, you saw how much it hit them, how much it hit all the players across multiple leagues when it seemed like sports may not continue. I think that was in late July. Maybe August.
Oh. Yeah, when Milwaukee was like, we're not playing today, and everyone was like, oh, man.
Yeah.
No, exactly. And I mean, we kind of saw it, like the players talking about, I mean, they have Black Lives Matter on the court. You're seeing their commercials, PSAs throughout their entire season. For you, I guess, what did you learn? What did you take away from these past, I mean, several months ever since the George Floyd shooting?
Man, I got to shout out the NBA because that it seemed like an easy decision. They made it fast, but they had to have known there was going to be repercussions, and they did it. They supported what their players wanted, and they found a way to throw that conversation into the spotlight. And I guess I would say to the NBA, like, mission accomplished. Like, obviously there's so much work to be done, but people are talking about it. Even the guy saying, I hate this, is talking about it. And not enough people were before. So I think that's awesome that it's forced people to be vocal. Like, so many people, even me, like, I wasn't an activist. I don't even know if it'd be fair to call myself an activist now, but I am vocal about it. And I'm talking to the people. I come from a community that's sheltered. So I have an opportunity and a responsibility to, you know, try to, you know, explain things and like let people know, like, the term white privilege isn't saying that you had an easy life. It's not saying that you haven't earned what you've got. It's saying that you get a benefit of the doubt just by existing that other people don't get. You know, if you're in a rich, wealthy neighborhood with three or four of your friends late at night and someone sees you, you get the benefit of the doubt, and other people don't get the benefit of the doubt. Like, that's not taking anything away from you, but you just have to be aware that that's the reality. It's the world we live in. So what was the question? Yeah. Just, I guess shout out the NBA to force that conversation on people. It's everyone is like, expressing their feelings and talking about how they feel, which is the first step, even if their feelings are, I disagree with this, I don't think it's necessary, you know, all lives matter. Even that, honestly, is better than silence. At least now we're talking. At least we're now we're exchanging ideas and we're exchanging opinions. And the more we do that, hopefully we can do it in a healthy, kind, understanding, compassionate way. But even if we're fighting, at least we're communicating, you know?
And you talk about how you've seen a lot. We're talking, going back to Joe and the Shaw. You know a lot of Joes. You've been around people who think that way, who are like that. You mentioned, like, you had these conversations. You can at least be there. What are those conversations like for you as a white guy? You're around these guys, around these people who are, like, have a more limited viewpoint, who may not see what the NBA is doing, what the WNBA is doing as, quote-unquote, right or helpful to the overall cause.
Yeah, I really see – the biggest thing I see from them is a lack of understanding and a defensiveness, you know, because they don't understand what people mean when they say Black Lives Matter. They hear my life doesn't matter. That's what they hear, which is not what's being said. But because they're not taking the time to understand, there's a lot of fear and a lot of defensiveness. There's a lot of which goes into anger. And then it's like stubbornness, you know, as they hear the message more and more, they don't want to hear it. And they start running out of like logical, reasonable reasons for that. Then they just get stubborn of like, oh, I'm not changing because I don't want to. I'm rambling. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but I think but I do think that bit by bit, like, it's forcing people to check themselves a little bit, even if in the moment they're stubborn and they don't feel, it doesn't seem like any progress is made. Then they go home and they think about it and they go, oh, that was a good point. Or, oh yeah, I guess I could think twice about that. Like, oh yeah, I never thought of it that way. And then, I'll be honest, what it, you know, 8 years ago, whatever it was, the first time I heard the phrase Black Lives Matter, my initial reaction was like, wait, what about me? Because that's human nature to be selfish. You know, I'm proud to say, it didn't take me long to be like, oh wait, that's not what this is. I get definitely for sure. I'm all about this. But so I guess I sort of see why people, that's not the right way to say it, because I don't want it to seem like it's okay for people to feel that way. But I can understand at least how someone would get there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And like, you know, you talked about not wanting to call yourself an activist or anything like that, but activism takes many forms, right? For some people, that is donating to these two causes. So like, you know, Minnesota Defense Fund or, you know, NAACP or whatever. For some people, that's actually being out on the front lines. But you also need people to have those sort of conversations, especially in white spaces, that frankly, like, you know, we don't get access to, or we are not always heard in. Like, you know, Jesse talked about 2020 being, you know, year of surprises. One of the things that we collectively saw as a big surprise was, and it might be a small thing, but like, I remember we were all on the phone and a tweet came up from Randy Orton. And he was like, Black Lives Matter. And then someone said, no, like, you know, Randy, you mean all lives? Like, that's the thing. Like, I didn't get it at first. But now, like, we're not saying Black Lives Matter only. We're saying Black Lives Matter too. And we were all sitting here thinking, like, what the? Like, Randy Orton's like the poster boy, like, rich, you know, Republican child, all that kind of stuff. And for him to say in 2020, no, like, this is where I stand. And it took me forever to finally, like, get this, like, it definitely is like a level of activism, like I said, that you have access to that, you know, maybe Jesse and I don't.
Holy crap, that was this year. Wow.
Yeah, right. This year has been super long.
It's full of surprises and a long year. And yeah, and that speaks to what I was saying earlier about like there being physiological and cultural differences. Like, and that actually, if you want to do that geographically, you can physically see that. But I also think, as Kobe was talking about, you know, we keep going back to Joel and the Shaw, but it's a reflection because you're speaking on a real thing, which is that sports is a microcosm of society. It in very much ways reflect society, the virtues, the vices. But unlike a mirror, like it's not passive. Sports is very active. It is in a lot of ways a news, a source of like news sources, right? You can literally tap in and pulse in and see a snapshot of where society is going every day. And, you know, if anything, you're seeing the friction that you're getting a lot from people, whether they're protesting for George Floyd or Breonna Taylor, or they're going even deeper and they're protesting for Tony McDade or you know, Jacob Blake, or especially Jacob Blake. And you saw that not only for the NBA, we saw how hard the WNBA has gone, especially Maya Moore has gone. And from all
We also saw, I don't mean to cut you off, Jesse, but I remember we were in high school when, I think we were in high school, when Derrick Rose was the first NBA player to wear an I Can't Breathe shirt, right?
No,
and that
Eric Garner. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the entire league started wearing that, you know, LeBron, Kobe, rest in peace. Like the entire league started doing this. And that was I wouldn't even say subtle, but they made a statement without actually having to like come out and do a press conference. Oh, this is what I'm doing. These are the, and they were just like, no, like this is where we are right now. Like you have to see the humanity in this person through me.
And that speaks to what Travis was saying. Like sports is political. That's a very political statement gesture to make. And I think, and from everything that we've seen from, you know, players standing up and speaking, whether it was LeBron James and the rest of the Banana Boat crew at the ESPY Awards standing up and speaking, or whether it is now, you still see that friction from people being upset about that. And then that goes back to being sports being a microcosm of society. Because anytime you bring up issues about race and racism, people have very different reasons for it, right? It goes personal. It goes regional. Those physiological and cultural differences that separate us. And you see that playing out when you got people from different walks of life clashing. And in a lot of ways, we saw that, you know, from the protests and stuff that we saw from the NBA and the WNBA. Got to constantly keep pointing them out because their activism really does matter, especially when they took the solidarity of the courts and used those Jacob Blake shirts that, you know, that represented the bullets and how many times he got shot.
Those were powerful, man, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. All right, y'all. We're going to take a really quick break. Jay, please play some music, some transition music, because we got really deep here. All right, Travis. Got to ask you a little bit on the lighter side. What is your favorite bad movie to watch?
Ooh, this is such a great question. The first ones that come to mind are sort of a shot at my wife. They're two of her favorite movies, and they're objectively bad. I love you. She's
right there. Oh no.
But that said, they're super quotable. They're a lot of fun to watch. They're great. The first one is Willow. And the second one is Labyrinth.
That's definitely trash.
Yeah.
That's definitely trash.
Yeah, right? They're awful, but they're so fun. I mean, Val Kilmer as Mad Mardigan, the greatest swordsman who ever lived. It's just so many quotable lines in that movie. So it is a lot of fun. David Bowie in Labyrinth. Is so cringy when he's dancing and singing that song. He has less rhythm than me, and that's really saying something. It's so cringy.
You got a little bit. I saw you in Ireland. You got a little bit.
I can move a little bit. Man, David Bowie, man, for being an amazing musician that he is, he cannot hold a rhythm, man. I don't know what he's doing, but it's cringy. Other than those two, one of my go-tos I used to watch with my dad all the time, This will show the redneck in me, is Tremors. I love Tremors, man.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a really deep cut.
I wish the listeners on your show could see your faces right now.
All right, cool.
Wow.
That brief moment. He said Tremors. Yeah. Y'all understand, like, that's a really real redneck movie to watch.
There's a scene in the movie where the tremor comes through the basement, and there's this guy and his wife who's got a wall full of guns. The scene's like 3 minutes long, and they just take the guns off the wall one at a time and unload like hundreds of rounds into this monster. I love it, man. It's so funny. I'm all about it. I am. I still have that redneck in me. I love that movie.
All right. Jesse, what about you?
So much judgment.
I shouldn't know. I know the scene's talking about. That's the part that's getting me right now.
It's okay. It's okay. I'm okay with the judgment. I deserve the judgment.
No. It's cool.
It's cool. This is going to be a curveball one. Travis Lincoln Cox, TLC. Do you prefer the group or do you prefer the match?
Like a WWE match, tables, ladders, and chairs.
Tables, ladders. Yeah. This is a little embarrassing, but when I was in, I was also going to say how old I am. I think it was like sixth or seventh grade was when TLC was like really it with like Don't Go Chasing Waterfalls and all that. And me and my friends bought that CD and would just play it. We would just put that whole CD and just play it, man. There's some good songs on that CD, man. So I would choose the group for sure.
Don't be embarrassed. That's real right there.
That's real.
That's real music.
That's real R&B.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, gee.
Are you not a WWE fan then?
You know, I do enjoy it, but I'm not a fan the way I listened to that episode when y'all went off about the different Royal Rumbles, your origin story. And I'm not a fan in that way, which is that's interesting. Right. There's the wrestling community, like the improv community and the wrestling community, there's actually a lot of crossovers. A ton of my improv fans are obsessed with wrestling. And I'll watch it. I do like it. And I think it's crazy what those guys do and how they're able to. I mean, I think why improvisers like it is a lot of the specifics of that match are improvised, you know. Yeah. And that's awesome. So I understand the appeal for sure. I never really got into it.
Okay, this might be a shot at your age, but like, you didn't even grow up like enjoying Hulk Hogan or even Bret the Hitman Hart. You didn't even grow up enjoying
Shawn Michaels.
You know, Shawn
Michaels. I did have a Hulk Hogan action figure, but I still wasn't like. I mean, I knew him, you know, more from his like commercials and other TV appearances than I did from wrestling. Yeah.
Gotcha. You give me three matches. You give me the opportunity let you watch three matches, Travis. I'm going to get you hooked. I guarantee.
Let's do it. I'm in.
Look, I didn't think I was here. Josh will tell you, like, because I forgot when you even introduced it to me, but like, I used to literally sit there and be like, why do y'all watch wrestling as grown people? Like that's literally how I thought. Like, I was like, like, what's the point? Like, what's the purpose? But then
I think I just need to watch a pay-per-view because I'll be watching them. I'll like, if it's on, I'll like put it on and I'll watch it. I'll be into it. And then right in the middle of the fight, they'll be like, we'll be right back. And I'm like, nah, I can't. I'm going to wait for this. I want to watch them fight. So then I'll change the channel.
Oh, yeah. No, I got you then.
Yeah. Cause even from like a creative standpoint, like those promotions.
They do. Oh yeah. The promos. Yeah. WWE is so good at video packages. Like they'll show you a 3 minute pack and you'll be like, all right, like I'm in. I want to see these two dudes kill each other. Like,
when we get paid out this podcast, that's gonna be us.
No, I'm not taking a bump. Are you kidding me? No,
no. I'm not saying like I'm gonna come out of nowhere with a TLC with Derek. I'm saying like we're gonna have like video promos.
Oh, I thought you were like, yeah, that's gonna be us.
We're gonna have good video packaging that looks like wrestling, or we're gonna look like the Young and the Restless. I have both of them. We're either going to do one or the other for promotion, all right?
Oh, man.
I love that.
I'm disappointed to hear about this, Travis, because I could definitely see you in the ring. You seem like I could got the whole character for you and everything.
Your name would be TLC.
He looks like Sami Zayn.
He does. He does look like Sami Zayn.
I'm just assuming that's a very attractive, handsome wrestler.
Oh, so handsome.
But your beard's not as wild as his right now. His has got way out of control. It's like everywhere.
Something like I can like spread this out here, get real crazy with it. Like, something like that.
Bring it back.
you look like a super villain.
Yeah, dude, it's just so gross. I don't know. I need to take care of this thing.
For sure. Yeah. So you've touched on it a little bit about you know, how you know Josh and the trip to Ireland and things like that. What is one of your favorite places that you've been to? It could be in the States, out of the States, you know.
Yeah. The obvious one for me is Ireland. I mean, my dad used to live there. I went back when I was a senior in high school. That's where my wife and I honeymooned. I've probably been back close to 10 times. There's something about that country. I don't know if you had the same experience, Josh, but every time I go back, I just love it there. I love the people, I love the culture, I love the landscape. Photography is a huge hobby of mine, and everywhere you point a camera in that country is just gorgeous. So I'm a huge fan of Ireland, but I only get there, you know, if I'm lucky, I can go once every couple of years. So outside of that, I would say just put me in the mountains above 7,000 feet, and I'm happy there. I love a high elevation, like camping in the mountains that's my happy place for sure.
Yeah, we had a bit of a different experience going to Ireland because I was like coming off of like graduation. You read my script for my final project or whatever, so you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, like it's definitely, you are right. I got some really dope pictures from it. It's a very beautiful country. I did enjoy going there.
Yeah.
Anyone got anything else?
I'm gonna get you in we're gonna get you into wrestling.
We're doing this. I actually DM'd you the picture of the wrestler we were talking about.
Let me check that out real quick. Where'd my phone go? Oh, I don't know. Do you have it on you? Sorry, my wife has my phone because her sister's coming over and she's got a buzzer in. Let me just, I wanna see this. We should get my reaction. You DM'd me. There it is. Okay. All right.
Oh, no.
That's fine. That's fine. Oh, no. No, that's fine. That's fine. No, that's fine. It's totally fine. Oh, I love it. No, I totally see it. That's totally fine. Yeah, great, great, great. Cool, so we're done?
That's like the nice way. So that's him saying.
So we're done, right? You guys are done? We're done now?
He was not.
That was the nicest, like, hell no.
Yeah. That's essentially the nice way of saying, hell no, I don't look like him.
It's really the beard.
He's going to talk. He's going to be, it's just Jugs podcast, terrible podcast. Just,
no. You guys think all white people look alike. I get it. All white people look the same. Duh.
Why would we ever say such an obvious thing?
Oh, man. Travis, it's just jokes. You know, it's all love.
All love for sure.
Is there anything else you would like to say, talk about?
No, man. I had a great time chatting with you guys. I love the show. I really do. I listen to every episode. I think you guys got a great thing here. I can't wait to hear what comes out next from y'all. And thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Where can the people find you?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm on Instagram at Travis L. Cox. Twitter, I think, is Trav L. Cox. Yeah, that's it. If you, do my improv team does live shows every Wednesday. If you want to check out some improv, and we're on Zoom right now, so there'll be no fingers in the mouth. Don't worry about that. Storm Chaser Improv. Check out Storm Chaser Improv on the gram. Yeah, thanks, guys.
Well, for Travis, for Jesse, for Kobe, for Derek, thank you all so much for listening. Thank you to King Boy and Jay Alizier for the outro music. We appreciate you. And tune in next time to another It's Just Jokes podcast. We'll see you guys next time.
Woo! Hey, hey.
This too hot.
Thanks, guys. That was really fun. Thanks for having me.